ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय This morning we are reading from 5th canto, 4th chapter entitled The Characteristics of Rishabdev, text 19. Since the verse is in the prose, so we'll just read it through. Sa kadachid atmano bhagavan rishabho brahma varta gato brahmarshi prava ram sabdhyam pra Prajnam Prajanam Nishamayan Tinam Atmajan Avahitatmanaham Prashraya Pranayam Bharasuyan Tritan Api upakshikshayan iti hovacham. Word by word translation. Saham, he, kadachit, once, atmanaham, while on a tour, bhagavan, The Supreme Personality of Godhead. Rishabham, Lord Rishabha. Brahma Vartagatta. When he reached the place known as Brahma Varta, Prabhupada in brackets mentions, identified by some as Burma and by others as a place near Kanpur, Uttar Pradesh. Brahma Rishi Pravara Sabhyam. In a meeting of first class Brahmanas, Prajanam, while the citizens, Nishamayantitam, were hearing, Atmajan, his sons. Avahita Atmanaham, attentive, Prashrayam, of good behavior, Pranayam, of devotion, Bharam, by an abundance, Suyan Tritan, well controlled, Api, although, Upa Shikshayan, teaching, iti, thus, ha, certainly, uvacha, said. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Sisi Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Once, while touring the world, Lord Rishabdev, the Supreme Lord, reached a place known as Brahmavarta. There was a great conference of learned brahmanas at that place, and all the king's sons attentively heard the instructions of the brahmanas there. At that assembly, within the hearing of the citizens, Rishabdev instructed his sons, although they were very well behaved, devoted and qualified. He instructed them so that in the future they could rule the world perfectly. Thus he spoke as follows. Purport. The instructions of Lord Rishabdev to his sons are very valuable if one wants to live peacefully within this world, which is full of miseries. In the next chapter, Lord Rishabdev gives his sons these valuable instructions. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 5th canto, 4th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Characteristics of Rishabdev, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Om Gyanati Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalaka Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Namo Vishnu Paraya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Shimate Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Prachadne Rivishesha Shunyavadi Paschati Reshitarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shedvaita Gadadara Shosari Gaura Bhaktivrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. Once while touring the world, Lord Rishabdev, the Supreme Lord, reached a place known as Brahmavarta. There was a great conference of learned Brahmanas at that place, and all the king's sons attentively heard the instructions of the Brahmanas there. At that assembly, within the hearing of the citizens, Rishabdev instructed his sons. Although they were already very well behaved, devoted and qualified, instructed them so that in the future they could rule the world very perfectly. Thus he spoke as follows. So from this verse we can conclude that actually Lord Rishabdev, while he was touring the world, as in the Vedic times of course every king or every monarch essentially would do, to observe the activities of the citizens. The point here is that while he was touring the world, that he didn't tour it alone, that along with him he was basically accompanied with his sons as a very practical experience. So to oversee the activities of citizens is the primary function of the king himself. Of course he has many others, but he has to be aware what is happening in each and every place that he is essentially entitled to or he is ruling over. We see from various other examples in the scriptures how in Vedic times the kings would tour and go all over the places and they would be conversant essentially with each and every place that was under their reign, that was under their rule. In Ramayana it's interesting that when monkeys were dispatched to search for Sita, Sugriva was very, very well conversed with all the lands of the world, actually with all the places, because he had been of course he had been ruling for some time. Later on the rule was taken over by the Bali, but he was very well conversed with each and every place. He was very well familiar with all of the places of this particular planet that he was ruling over. So this is one of the important features that a king has to be aware, not just about, say, geographical positions of various lands that he possesses, but he has to be aware, the most essentially, with the activities of the citizens. That is the duty of the king, that he sees that each and every person essentially is properly engaged in whichever, according to his nature, varna or ashrama, he belongs, so that the society can function properly. We heard in the earlier verses that citizens were very peaceful, very satisfied. There was no any need, there was no any for anything artificial, anything extraordinary, anything different, and they were so satisfied with whatever activities they were performing and the gain that they were receiving from such kind of activities. So they were perfectly satisfied. And it's natural if we engage ourselves according to our propensities that naturally we'll be satisfied and we won't have to be forced to perform any kind of activity. Of course in Krishna consciousness there is an important principle of utility. Srila Prabhupada speaks about utility as the principle. So very often we do have to perform activities that might not be exactly according to our psychophysical nature, but essentially at some point we are granted, we arrange particular kind of service and particular kind of activities that actually we can perform better, that we can be inspired, that we can really contribute, because that is what is required, that's for our spiritual advancement. We can't be idle. We know that idle mind, as the saying goes, is the devil's workshop. So we have to be engaged. And therefore, if we are engaged according to our psychophysical nature, then everything works perfectly fine. And this is what the duty of the king essentially is, to see that everybody is perfectly engaged. And if somebody performs duty of somebody else, that is very actually detrimental for even that person's particular, what to speak of, spiritual life, even in the material world. Like we know again the example of the Ramayana, when particular person of the Shudra background was performing austerities, and that actually was creating disturbances. So that's why Krishna says that essentially every activity, every work has some fault within it. For Kshatriya to kill, it's not a very nice business. It's not a very nice thing to do. But they have to do it. It is their duty. For Vaishyas maybe to cheat at some point to gain some profit. It's not the most wonderful thing, or the quality, so to say. But they have to do it. So each and every person actually has some particular activities that he has to perform, but not necessarily that they are all ultimately the most wonderful kind of activities that can be imagined in the service of Lord Krishna, but of course from various points of views. So Lord Rishabdev, he, as I said, compared to the modern governmental system that, where the education essentially and the emphasis is on one particular branch of either knowledge or one particular type of economical development, so that everybody is kind of forced into that particular streamline, whatever the necessity say is. Say at some point necessity is that everybody, you know, should be kind of having some kind of a medical education, because that's something that is at the moment highly paid or respected. Or somebody should be, say, like an engineer, or that's something that is very respectable or necessary. So these are modern trends. And because of that, a lot of people actually suffer. We see many students that are coming and they're disclosing, saying that, you know, whatever they're essentially doing might not be really just from their own, that they have undertaken just from their own desire, that is from their own heart, but just because there is a pressure of the society, there is a pressure from the parents. There are so many different kinds of pressure, so they have been undertaking all these various kinds of studies or even later on activities just because it's considered something prestigious and important. So this is the modern setup. So government essentially, they don't really care about engaging the citizens, as I said, according to their own psychophysical nature, but they are mostly concerned that what is it that is going to economically boost the whole system, the whole basically different kinds of affairs of a country that they can seemingly be prosperous for the country itself and maybe for the citizens. That's the very secondary thought. So that this is the modern scenario. Compared to this, what we see here, when Lord Rishabdev, as we heard, he was touring and he was making sure that everybody lived peacefully and happily, being engaged in various kinds of activities that brought them prosperity and satisfaction. So here, another point is, as I mentioned in the beginning, that Lord Rishabdev, he didn't tour alone. Of course, we know the king, wherever he goes, he has his own entourage that follows. He might go alone, like in case of Lord Ramachandra, maybe to incognito, to see maybe some kind of a different kinds of affairs, what is going on in the kingdom or oversee or overhear something that might not be publicly so well known. But essentially, they're accompanied by various kinds of other ministers or people who help. It's a whole huge entourage that follows the king. And in this case, Lord Rishabdev, as a perfect king or a perfect example of a perfect father as well, because that's as another role that he played. He took it along with himself, all of his sons, all of his 100 sons. And they reached at one particular place where there was an assembly of the Brahmanas. Here an important point is that first of all, Lord Rishabdev made sure that his sons were learning from the proper source. There was an assembly of the Brahmanas, and he sat down along with his sons, and they kept on hearing the instructions, the most valuable instructions meant for the human beings. Of course, they learned various kinds of, we know that essentially Brahmanas would speak about the different kinds of subjects and topics. Mostly we know that the Vedic knowledge contains more or less the karma kanda, various kinds of karma kanda processes and activities. But essentially they were also speaking about the ultimate goal of life, ultimate truth. And Lord Rishabdev, as the duty is of a father as well as the king, he was also making sure that his sons were educated properly. And this is another important point, because nowadays, as we see, we have the experience that is not such a high concern in the society, that citizens or the subjects or those who are dependent on, say, like in the case of the son to the father or citizen to the state, that they are not properly directed about the terms and the means of the goal of life. So Lord Rishabdev made sure that that is the case in his own sons, because those sons, as is explained here, they were destined to rule in the future, and therefore they themselves, not just for the sake of their own personal liberation, but for the sake of the whole world, they were meant to guide others as well. So they themselves had to become perfect. In the general relationship between the father and the son, the relationship is more kind of a conditioned. It's a conditioned relationship. That is the psychology. Father usually has some kind of expectation from the sons. And if that kind of expectation is not fulfilled, then there might be even tendency that a father will reject his son. So this is the case, actually, in each and everyone's relationship in terms of father and the son. There are a lot of different kinds of examples where father being dissatisfied with the son may have tendency basically to reject him if that tendency is not fulfilled. Psychologically, again, the son is the expansion of the father. In very often, many cases actually, if father doesn't fulfill some of his desires, he's not able to fulfill some of his hankerings and things that he considers very important in the life, then he will project this on his son. And he will urge his son to try to fulfill the same. Like there was one case, there was one devotee I know. He was playing a tennis. And he wasn't so interested in it. That's kind of playing, he was good in some ways, but he wasn't really interested in performing such kind of activity. He wasn't interested really. I mean, he liked the sports, but not really to the extent to which his father actually wanted him to achieve. And he said that he was so frustrated, he was so depressive, he was so depressed, because every time he would lose, his father would make a huge pressure upon him. His father had huge expectations. Then sometimes he was winning, he was quite good in some ways, but essentially he was also losing. And then his father would create various kinds of scenes at home and create a lot of pressure upon him that he should perform better, he should exercise better, and all different kinds of things that are related to such kind of activity. And he said, till nowadays, of course, he had such a deep negative impression about his father because of such kind of a pressure that has been put upon him. And for him it was very, very difficult actually to come out of that depressive state and having such kind of relationship. We know that essentially a relationship that initially is gained through such kind of a different kinds of dealings, it stays quite long in our as an impression in our minds. Because Father essentially represents the authority. And also when we come to the spiritual life, we also have to accept an authority. We also have to accept somebody who is, say, like a guru, who is like an authority that actually can lead our life. So if some kind of impression of earlier is negative towards the authorities, that also such kind of a psychologically impression may be reflected upon the relationship with the guru itself. So he had a lot of difficulties in this way. But somehow or other, as he's progressing, he's now several years in Krishna consciousness, so things are getting a little more stable, and he's ready to accept said authority, and especially, of course, from the point of Krishna consciousness, and somehow even stabilize his relationship with the Father, from which he actually essentially just wanted to stay away as much as possible, because he has been the source of so many difficulties actually for him. So this is the very great danger, as I said, if the father projects various kinds of expectations upon his son that he considers to be very important, but not considering his son's, say, psychophysical nature. He's just concerned basically about more or less himself. So that is not the case here, what we hear about Lord Rishabhdev. Lord Rishabhdev, of course, is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he is the ideal example. As we hear here, ideal example of the king, and of course as we hear, the ideal example of the father. And as the father, he knows perfectly well what is the most suited, what is the most important for his sons. And through the reciprocation, what we will hear later on, we know that his sons were highly, highly exemplary personalities. Now Bharat Maharaj, Navayogendras and other sons, they were highly, highly qualified, and this has been also mentioned here in this particular verse. So the role of the father is so important in the initial, actually, stages of anybody's life. We know that Srila Prabhupada, he gives the credit to his father. He said actually that he was my first guru. He gives a lot of credit, most of the credit, even more in one sense than to his spiritual master Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj, because he said he laid down the foundation of his spiritual life. When his mother, Srila Prabhupada would explain, he would say that his mother wanted to send him to the West, to the London, to become a barrister. But then his father objected. He said that he would be influenced by that Mlecha culture, and you know, he will lose his spiritual life. So he wouldn't agree to that. And when Srila Prabhupada also, he was encouraging, there were many other instances, but essentially he was encouraging Srila Prabhupada to have like a Ratha Yatra when he was very small, to play Mridanga, to learn Mridanga, to go for Mridanga classes. And of course his father would very often invite various kinds of sages for the lunch. Almost every day Srila Prabhupada explains that they would have an opportunity to feed or to have association with some kind of a sadhu. So that impression was so deep in his mind that definitely there was no any other room for different kinds of other thoughts rather than something related directly to the spiritual life. So that initial impression is so essential. Of course, later on in later days, everybody gets influenced by the teen life and maybe can even sway away, like speaking about maybe in some Gurukul, examples of some Gurukulis or whatever. Or even now, in our own example, we know how in those particular ages the senses have become very much influenced or very active. So even say if there is, or even if there isn't, even at that stage it might be some kind of a deviation, so to say, but because of good impressions, how important it is to have a good impressions, then later on we'll understand the values of that particular Krishna consciousness. So very important upbringing is emphasized here, because those sons who are following Lord Rishabhdev, they're so faithful to him. They're so grateful. They're so grateful essentially, because they, since of having those particular qualities, they are very receptive to Krishna consciousness. They hear from the Brahmanas, and as it is stated here, they also hear later on from Lord Rishabhdev himself. So he directly, he instructs his sons But he also makes sure that they're instructed by the personalities who are also highly qualified from various different kinds of angles of spiritual life. Interestingly, Lord Rishabdev, it is stated here that there were other citizens present at that particular assembly, and they also had the benefit to hear instructions of Lord Rishabdev. So that bond actually between son and the father is very strong, but like I said, it is somehow or other, it is conditional. It is conditional. Of course, in the case of Lord Rishabdev, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so everything is perfect. We know that no ordinary living being appears as his son. In the case of Lord Krishna and Dvaraka, all the sons essentially that he had, they were all demigods, they were all exemplary personalities, very special personalities. But in another case that we can see from Mahabharata, Dhritarashtra also had hundreds of sons, but none of them essentially were devotees, except one, which stepped on Yuyutsu, he stepped on the Pandavas' side and fought for the Pandavas. They had a different kind of a character. So the son is something that actually, of course, can extend the family line, or can become an heir to the throne and extend the dynasty, or there are various kinds of benefits that, or in the case of Karmakanda, perform some certain Shraddha ceremony and elevate the whole dynasty, so to say. So sons have various kinds of functions, but the son can be also, in a case like we see Duryodhana, can be very detrimental for the whole family. When Duryodhana was born, as very inauspicious omens appeared on the sky, and Dhritarashtra was advised by all the seniors to reject him, to discard him, because that son, it was understood that he will bring the ruin to the whole dynasty. But because Dhritarashtra was so affectionate to his son, he wasn't able to do so. And even later on, during the whole Mahabharata drama that was going on, he was so many times advised by the elders not to follow and support his son Duryodhana, but because of that strong affection, that strong bond that he had, he was still unable to do so. So here we see that the conflict, actually, we see two different sides, that of course in relationship of the father to the son, that there can be very strong affection, and there can also be very strong disappointment or rejection towards the son. So there are different kinds of expectations. It's not like some kind of relationship that person can have, that the mother, for example, has for her child. That is less conditional. But a father's love is more conditional. But still, there is some affection. There can be a lot of affection, like in the case of Dhritarashtra. But of course, it was very unhealthy affection. Srila Prabhupada gives one example. He says that there was a case of two brothers quarreling, and one brother killed another. But the father, still, he was so affectionate that he pleaded to the judge, saying that, "Now I have only one son, so please spare him, so that at least I can have one son." So in the course of negotiations, then the judge agreed to leave that son alive, basically, so that at least father can have one son, although that son was a criminal kind of. So there is that kind of affection present there as well. But essentially, sons are there to, like Chanyaka Pandit said, if it's a good son, then it's like a flower which can make the whole forest fragrant. But if it's the bad son, then it's like a thorns in the forest. Or like Hiranyakashipu would say to Prahlad Maharaj, you're like the infectious, like a part of the body that is infected. It has to be cut off. It has to get rid of. But we know, of course, Prahlad Maharaj was the greatest devotee, and that's just the opposite example, actually, that was the real case. So Prahlad Maharaj was actually the most exemplary person, most exemplary son. But due to Hiranyakashipu's envy and material ambitiousness, definitely he wasn't able to recognize this. because of all his anger and negative qualities that he had. So Prahlad Maharaj was embodying the most greatest, actually the best example of somebody in the position of a son in relationship to the father. Like in the case of Lord Kapiladev and Mother Devahuti. There is a story also when Srila Prabhupada was in Los Angeles, and Hridananda Maharaj, he brought his mother actually to see Srila Prabhupada. And Srila Prabhupada was praising Hridananda Maharaj very much, saying that he is a very intelligent person. And he told a story about Lord Kapiladev and Devahuti. And he said that because Lord Kapiladev, although he was the son, he was so elevated and spiritually advanced that he could actually instruct his mother. So he pointed out to the mother of Hridananda Maharaj that actually she should hear from him. She should learn also so many valuable instructions from her son because he is highly qualified. So there are various kinds of cases. It's not like, you know, very often in terms of relationship with the parents, it's very difficult to preach to them. It's almost impossible. They will never to accept anything, whatever we say, although it might be very beneficial and very intellectual and very spiritually meaningful. But in some cases, at least if parents hear maybe from somebody else, like senior, like Srila Prabhupada in this case, then they will be maybe ready to accept even the instruction given by their sons. So that wasn't the case, like in the example of Daksha. When he heard the instructions of Sati about the greatness of Lord Shiva, because he was also very envious and very offensive, he wasn't able to accept such a good advice of Sati. And that's something that caused her a lot of distress. So there are various kinds of dealings in such kind of relationship, son and father relationship. But here we see in the case of Lord Rishabhdev that he properly prepared them. As we know from Srimad Bhagavatam, of course, nobody should become a father or a teacher if they are not able to deliver their dependence from these miseries of material existence. So definitely Lord Rishabhdev, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he was the most qualified to do so, and therefore he instructed his sons, as we will hear in the next chapter, about the real nature of this material world and essence of the human existence. Of course, how to rule, he instructed them in terms of various kinds of material activities, and which will be beneficial not just for them themselves, but instructions which will be beneficial for everybody, all the citizens that they are dependent upon them. So here we also see that in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says, instructions of Lord Rishabhdev to his sons were very valuable, pointing out that if one wants to live peacefully within this material world which is full of miseries. So that's another point to understand, that what means peaceful living. Nowadays nobody even knows how to live peacefully. Nobody even knows how to utilize the things that are here in this material world properly. In earlier times, at least, demons, they were ready to accept the Vedic teachings, and they knew, they understood how powerful the Vedic teachings actually are, and they became very powerful and they became very influential. So understanding that the Vedic knowledge is a perfect knowledge, of course the means may differ, means may not be so positive, they might be also negative, like in the case of demons. But the teachings of the Vedas are so powerful. This is what is the point here. So the demons, they also knew how to enjoy, like in case of Jarasandha, in case of Kamsa. They became very powerful by practicing the Vedic rituals, practicing the Vedic process. And this is why in the case, like here we see, that instructions of Lord Rishabhdev to his son have been accepted in a spiritual, in a positive manner. But the demons, who have the different kind of nature, they use the same instructions and they manipulate them, utilizing them for their own different kind of negative means. Of course, for them themselves, they consider them to be very positive. Vedas speak about various kinds of stages. There are various kinds of artas or activities. There is a dharma, artha, kama, moksha, of course. Ultimate is lotus feet of Lord Krishna. But to achieve sense gratification, economic development, everything has been mentioned in the Vedic scriptures. How to do all these different kinds of things. And by following it, anybody can become satisfied in this material world. Nowadays we're hearing so much about sense gratification and different kinds of activities that will supposedly satisfy everyone, but ultimate result, everybody is depressed and miserable. Nobody gets any satisfaction. It's just some kind of a material illusion. It's an illusion basically to think that gratifying senses is going to bring us happiness and satisfaction. This is what one psychologist, he pointed out, that of course the whole body, the whole our body is equipped with different kinds of urges for sense gratification and different kinds of objects to satisfy it. And therefore in interaction with those particular objects, the person can try to achieve some kind of satisfaction. But the problem is, and of course in interactions with many other individuals, to fulfill those kinds of needs, to fulfill those kinds of urges. But the problem is that the matter cannot satisfy the spirit. People don't understand that the material nature, that the matter cannot satisfy our real self, and that is the spirit. So it's an illusory to perform any kind of activities and think that it's going to bring us satisfaction. Even Einstein said that it's a kind of a madness to keep on performing, to keep on getting, actually performing the same activity over and over and expect to derive different kind of result. So this is what is going on in the name of enjoyment and satisfaction in this material world. People try various kinds of things and performing them again and again and again, and they try to achieve satisfaction, but just satisfaction is not there. It's not happening. And they always point out that there is this problem and that problem. The problem is just somewhere out there. And maybe if you do in this particular way or in that particular way, then you will achieve some kind of happiness and satisfaction. But it's just not happening. The problem is somewhere out there. This is what objective intellectualism would suggest. There is that interesting Bengali story which very nicely illustrates that point about a thief. There was in one village always some kind of a night. There was a night burglar coming and mysteriously stealing various kinds of things from the houses. So at some point the villagers have organized some kind of a group of people, some kind of a watchmen, and organized themselves to try to catch that mysterious burglar that was going on and plundering throughout the village. So finally one man spotted somebody getting into one particular house, and they surrounded the house, and somebody started shouting, "Catch the thief, catch the thief, catch the thief." And then the thief was so intelligent that actually he used that kind of a situation, and while he was coming out of the house, he frantically pointed out somewhere out in the distance, "There goes the thief, there goes the thief, run after them." And then everybody started running in the different kind of in that particular direction. So this is how that thief actually escaped, running again in another way. So similarly here in material world, people don't recognize that actually the real cause of all difficulties and problems is the false ego. And that false ego is that we try to enjoy material nature, that we are trying to exploit this material nature for our own satisfaction, and this is the way towards happiness. But it's not. So they said, so thinking like this, that trying to adjust particular circumstances, that this is something that's going to bring us happiness and satisfaction, but it is never the case. So this is similar like that thief story, the problem or some kind of a imaginary object of our difficulties is just out somewhere there. No, it's right here. It's right here amongst us. And it is that false ego that actually we are nourishing every day identifying ourselves with this particular material body. So nowadays, this is the reason essentially why people even can't enjoy this material world, even to an extent to which even demons were able to do so, because demons were following the Vedic teachings. They knew these are the perfect instructions, even materially, to achieve some kind of level of satisfaction. Nowadays people don't even know, they don't even know that much. What to speak of anything higher, anything spiritual. So these instructions by Lord Rishabhdas, as you see, his sons benefited so much because they were pious, they were devoted, they had such a good qualities, they understood the real import of those particular teachings. But there are those thinking, comparing themselves to that false ego, relating themselves to this material body, that they are misusing those teachings. They are just not ready to follow the real instructions, and they are misinterpreting. We know that Lord Rishabhdev, as it is mentioned here, he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he gives the topmost instruction for the ultimate liberation. But there are also people who are not ready to follow, they just want to imitate, they just want the result, but they don't want to follow the process. Like we know later on, a few more chapters ahead, we will hear of one particular king, Arhat, who actually imitated Lord Rishabhdev. He wanted to achieve the same result, but he didn't follow his instructions. Very often in the world, in this world also, in the Western world, people would say, only some kind of imitation or the fate is enough, and we don't have to follow any instructions. So that's wrong, that's false, because we see that the result, again, it won't be the same. Fate is, yes, initial step on the progress of the spiritual life. Of course, it is continuous, it is always present there, but there are many other stages as well. As we know from Nectar of Devotion, there is a fate, there is sadhu sangha, there is bhajana kriya and artha nivritti and so on. So fate is important, it is initial, of course it continues throughout the rest of the stages, but it's not the only one. Instructions are also very important. So that king imitated the activities of Lord Rishabhdev, but essentially he misguided everybody. As we pointed out earlier, the demonic personalities, they use Vedic knowledge to become powerful and to enjoy and to achieve some kind of material satisfaction. So once the demons, on such basis of following the Vedic principles, they defeated the demigods. And demigods complained to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They came to the shore of the Milk Ocean and they complained to the Lord Vishnu that this is the situation. We have been defeated by demons who became so powerful by following the Vedic process. Please give us some remedy, or please help us to come out of this terrible situation. So the Lord Vishnu expanded one particular illusory form that looked like a mendicant, a naked mendicant with the peacock feathers in his hand. And he said, I will relieve you from all your distress, be assured of that. And that particular mendicant, which was expansion of Lord illusory form, arrived at the place that was on the bank of Narmada River, where the demons were performing different kinds of austerities. So that mendicant inquired from the demons, why are you performing all these different kinds of sacrifices and austerities? Is it for the happiness and prosperity in this particular life, or you're aiming at something even higher, that is afterlife kind of? So they replied, it is just for this particular existence that we are performing this particular austerities. And then he said that if you really want to achieve liberation, if you really want to achieve emancipation from this material existence, then actually you should follow my instructions. You shouldn't follow this particular type of instructions. And he was pointing out to the various kinds of defects of the Vedic knowledge. The whole idea is to sway them away from the Vedic process and make them practice something completely misguiding that has nothing to do with the real result essentially that could be achieved. So he pointed out that they should worship mendicants in the form of the Jain form and worship the forms of Arhat rather than any other activities or sacrifices or devotional services that are mentioned there in the Vedic scriptures. He was finding faults in the Vedas, pointing out that if sacrificed, for example, animal goes to the heaven, then why wouldn't person take advantage of this process and sacrifice his father and send him to the heaven as well? Then he said it's the wasteless thing to pour butter into the fire. He gave another example saying that if Indra, who is in the heaven, feeds upon the wood that is cast into the fire, that he is no better than the brute who feeds on the leaves. They said also Shraddha ceremony, pointing out, he was deriding the Vedic knowledge, saying that what is the benefit? Who eats this particular food? Actually only Brahmanas are benefited afterwards, who eat that particular food offered to them, and not the person to whom it is meant for. So he was coming up with various kinds of false arguments against the Vedic teachings, and sure enough, those demons rejected the Vedic teachings, started deriding demigods, started deriding Brahmanas and all the scriptures, and that was ultimately the cause of their fall down. They lost the powers, and when demigods unleashed another battle against them, the demons were defeated. They lost the powers. So that's the importance of the Vedic knowledge, the purity and power of the Vedic knowledge that is there, that if we follow the Vedas, definitely there are so many things and results that can be achieved, but of course which can be misused, like in the case of this mendicant. I don't know if any of you know, how did King Vena essentially become degraded? Of course he was degraded initially from his birth, he had all different kinds of negative qualities, but later on he was also approached by such kind of a mendicant who was representing the same teachings, and this is how King Veda essentially stopped respecting Brahmanas and performing Vedic sacrifices, and this was the real cause of his fall down, because he accepted such kind of teachings as the ultimate teachings. So they have been misguided. They of course initially didn't have the proper attitude, they didn't have proper understanding of the ultimate goal of life, but they became powerful by practicing the Vedic systems, and therefore by being misled into the other kind of practice, they lost those powers, at least because they didn't practice the Vedic knowledge. So these are the ways that sometimes Lord Krishna takes, just to divert the atheistic class of people towards the Vedic teachings, because they're misusing them for their own selfish purposes and harming everybody else. So like in this case, instructions, they're the most beneficial, but depending on the recipient, they have the various kinds of results. So Lord Rishabdev here is instructing his sons into the highest matters of the spiritual life and human existence, and everybody can essentially benefit from those kind of teaching if he doesn't have any selfish motivation. So Hare Krishna, I'll stop here. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, please.
Devotees, those devotees who are practicing Krishna consciousness, how do they know whether they are really liberated or they are still to be liberated?
So those who practice Krishna consciousness, how do they know that they are liberated?
Or they are still to be liberated.
They are still to be liberated. Srila Prabhupada gives an example, it's like somebody who is waiting for a shower, who is in the line. In the case of those who don't know that they are liberated, they can be understood to be like in the line for taking a shower. So they'll become purified, they'll become liberated in the course of time. Or the example of the ripe and the green mango. So someone who follows the process, it's just a matter of the time when the person will become liberated essentially. And how to know whether somebody is liberated or is not liberated is just a question of our attraction of towards Krishna and Krishna consciousness. If we still have material desires and material attachments, then definitely we are not liberated then. But we can become liberated even in this body, but of course that depends on our activities and our attraction towards this Krishna and the process itself.
That means a devotee, even if he has the slightest material desire, that he is not liberated. Am I correct?
Yeah, he is not liberated. But he is on the way to be liberated. Might take some time. Or like Srila Prabhupada said, even if somebody might be having some desires, he will take them away. He will take their desire away and bring them back to the spiritual world. Yeah, is that okay? Kananta Prabhu.
Yes, you were speaking about psychophysical nature. The psychophysical nature and accordingly being employed, kept occupied. I was remembering when I was younger, I'm from a Kerala Palghat Iyer family supposedly. At a very young age, father was giving me Mepatur, Bhattacharya's Narayaniyam and Poondanam, this Jnanapana, Vaishnava literature I was reading, and I wanted to be a teacher, but when father left untimely, I had to care for four younger sisters and brothers, and the societies and family pressures brought me into a research job with an international company called Bayer, and I was a research scientist in agrochemicals in crop fields against pests and fungi and weeds. I used to test chemicals for 28 years, but I was utterly miserable, though I was looked up at by peer colleagues and neighbors and everyone.
So this was a comment.
Yes, a comment.
Ananta Prabhu said that he was brought by his father chanting Narayaniyam prayers and everything, but later on he was somehow or other working in the company, swayed away from those practices, right? So how important is, but still here you are, right? That was the, because of such a good samskara that was initially implanted in your consciousness. Okay, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.